Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Kerry Curtis, a member of the club's Board of Governors and your chair for today. We welcome our listening audience and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, David Lewis. And this evening is more than just a standard Commonwealth Club event. It's kind of a celebration because this is the 50th anniversary of the founding of Save the Bay. And it's hard to believe that 50 years ago, the bay was in danger of becoming a polluted, narrow shipping channel. And that is very true if you look at some of the old diagrams of what was planned for those times. The bay wouldn't exist today if those plans had been carried out. But now, a half century later, the Bay Area is poised to host the biggest and most prestigious regatta in the world, the America's Cup, right here on San Francisco Bay. And that's quite a turnaround. So it seems clear to me and to most people that San Francisco Bay would not exist as the beautiful natural treasure that it is without the organization Save the Bay. We all owe a big thank you to the three pioneering women who founded it 50 years ago, Kay Kerr, Sylvia McLaughlin, and Esther Gulick. And by the way, at Save the Bay, there are plenty of volunteer opportunities, so you can go visit the website savesfbay.com.org. To sign up for a volunteer project and to find out what everything is going on. So now I'd like to talk a little bit about the leader of Save the Bay for the last 10 years, Executive Director David Lewis. He's been Executive Director since 1998, and by virtue of his position, he is the most prominent advocate for San Francisco Bay. Under his leadership, Save the Bay stopped San Francisco International Airport's plan to pave more of the bay for runways. Has taken on industry giants, Cargill, the American Chemistry Council, and some serious bay polluters. David has testified before Congress on oil spill prevention and on restoring bay wetlands to combat the impacts of climate change. David was born and raised in the Bay Area, and prior to joining Save the Bay, he devoted 14 years to work for nuclear arms control in Washington, including in the U.S. Senate, and worked on the election campaigns across the country. He holds a BA in politics and American studies from Princeton University, is an advocate gardener and soccer dad, but is still trying to catch up to his daughters on the ski slope. Please join me in welcoming David Lewis.
Well, thank you very much, Kerry, and thank you all for coming. It's a pleasure to be back at the Commonwealth Club, which does such a great job of highlighting prominent issues in the San Francisco Bay Area and bringing great speakers here. So, Kerry gave you a little bit of background about me, and I think for our purposes tonight, the most important part of my biography is that I'm from the Bay Area. I was born and raised here. And it turns out that I'm 50 years old. Just a few days ago, actually, so turning 50 the same year that, say, the Bay is turning 50. So there's some nice parallelism there. Say the Bay was founded in 1961, the same year that I was born, and it is the oldest and largest membership organization that works exclusively to protect, restore, and celebrate San Francisco Bay. And we do have a lot to celebrate, and that's what I'm going to talk to you about tonight. And as the leading champion for the Bay, Say the Bay is really committed to making the Bay cleaner and healthier for people and for wildlife. The Bay is an amazing natural treasure in the midst of 7 million people, and it's really vital to our quality of life and our economy here in the Bay Area. It's a big part of who we are and how we see ourselves here in this community. It's the largest estuary on the West Coast, and an estuary is where salt and fresh water meet. And it's also the most altered estuary. And that change that occurred here in San Francisco Bay happened in a relatively short period of time, really just about 100 years after the gold rush. So the Bay, in spite of all that growth and development, still hosts a wealth of wildlife. And even though it's a fraction of what was here before European settlement, there's still quite a bit. Now, how many of you are actually members of Save the Bay? It's quite a few. And how many of you have seen all or some of the series of films on KQED called Saving the Bay? So some of you have heard parts of this story of the Bay and of Save the Bay, and it's really the Bay Area's story. It's all of your stories and mine. We, the people who live in the Bay Area, are the reason that we still have a bay. And our history and our recent successes in bringing the bay back from near death really demonstrate that together all of us can make a difference in our communities. So when I was born in 1961, the bay was really on the verge of death. And that was just a century after the massive population influx to the region began, starting in the gold rush, through the earthquake of 1906 and the World War II boom in development. The bay had literally become a dump. This photograph of cars dumped in the bay in Sausalito is a good example of what you would have seen around the time that I was born. Also, at the time, raw sewage was flowing into the bay from every city, and it made the water unsafe to swim in and the fish unfit to eat. And there was toxic waste being poured into the bay. Decades later, this particular site I'm showing you was declared a Superfund toxic waste site. It's a couple of miles from where I grew up, but at the time, there weren't any regulations on this factory and what it could do. There was garbage being trucked from every city to the shoreline of the bay and being dumped there, both to get rid of the garbage and to create new land. And now you can see these former dumps. Most of the hills near the shoreline, so-called hills, are actually capped landfills, not naturally occurring hills. Well, sometimes the garbage was burned to reduce its volume and create room for more garbage. And the glow of those shoreline fires could be seen from the hills. This particular example is Coulee Landing in East Palo Alto in the 1950s. The bay was being filled for ports, marinas, factories, freeways, shopping malls, airports, subdivisions. This is Sausalito and Richardson Bay, and this is a great example of how most of the shoreline of the bay was shallow, and so the shallow marsh areas were the first areas to be diked and drained for agriculture and for salt production facilities, some of which until recently still existed in the South Bay. This is a photo of Burlingame just south of the airport, and you can see another example of dump trucks filling in shallow areas of the bay for land. This is right near Coyote Point. So in the 100 years leading up to 1960, an average of 4 square miles per year of the bay was filled, and that total effort reduced the bay's size by about a third. So the bay was literally disappearing before people's eyes. Here's another familiar sight looking south on Candlestick Causeway with Brisbane off to the right at the time that causeway was being built. So 90% of the fertile marshes and mudflats that were at the edge, the shallow edges of the bay, were being diked and filled using dirt and garbage, and there were some even more elaborate schemes. You see on the right of this photo is San Bruno Mountain, and there was a proposal to chop down a lot of San Bruno Mountain and using a conveyor belt, take the fill right down to the western edge of the bay and create new land all the way from Candlestick Point to Redwood City. Here's Oakland Airport looking south, also all on filled land. And this kind of filling was possible because the bay waters and the shallow areas under the bay belonged to each city. And most of them were using their bay shorelines to dispose of sewage and garbage dumps and landfill. They all had aspirations of having more land for urban development. And with an average depth of 14 feet throughout the bay, you can see that it was relatively easy to create new land from the bay. Here's Berkeley. This is the intersection of Interstate 80 and University Avenue. And to the left is the former dump. Now it's the former dump. At the time, it was just being closed off. And Berkeley, in the early 60s, was proposing to fill in 2,000 more acres of its bay shoreline to literally double the size of the city. Now, if you look on the right side of this photo, you can see railroad tracks. And they're going parallel to Interstate 80. And that's pretty much where the original shoreline was. So you can see how much had already been filled in by that point. Well, so here's a map showing the wetlands that were present in the bay in 1850 and how much of that had been eliminated. The green areas are wetlands on the left-hand side in 1850, and by 1998, how many of those had been either filled in and paved over or diked off for different uses. So in the late 50s, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers did a study for the Department of Commerce that showed that 60% of the remaining bay was shallow enough to be filled for development, and that would have left only a narrow river for navigation. This was a cartoon-like depiction of that study in the Oakland Tribune in 1959, and this simplified diagram with the headline Bay or River really crystallized the choice that was before the Bay Area, and it ignited regional concern about the future of the bay. So it was in that environment that three women, Esther Gulick, Sylvia McLaughlin, and Kay Kerr, who were living in the East Bay Hills and could see the destruction of the bay from their homes, they decided they wanted to stop it. And in 1961, they approached the Sierra Club and other conservation leaders and asked for their help. And those leaders, all of whom happened to be men, told them, basically, we're busy, we have a lot to do, it's a great idea, start your own organization. Nobody really gave them much of a chance for a number of reasons, not the least of which that they were women. And remember that at this point in time, there had been no Earth Day, no ecology movement, no environmental laws. These women had not much money and not much apparent access to power. They didn't have cell phones, computers, or email. And yet in just a few years, they somehow managed to mobilize more than 20,000 people to join their organization for $1 a year, and it became the Save the Bay movement. They started fighting individual cities' bay fill plans, and that simple Bay or River image cartoon really helped. Filling the bay began to be seen as an attack on the bay and an attack on the public's interests, as in this San Francisco Chronicle cartoon, which you see the dump truck backing up to the bay, and it says, SF Bay Fill Company, Instant Land, our specialty. Well, Save the Bay brought people by the busloads to Sacramento to lobby the legislature, and the short version of the story is, in just 4 years, they managed to get the state of California to declare in a law that the bay belonged to the people and place a moratorium on additional filling of the bay. They created a study commission to look at what the bay needed to be protected and how it should be regulated and to develop a San Francisco Bay plan. And this was really Save the Bay's first great victory. in this cartoon, you can see the train rushing down the track and the engineer saying, curses foiled again, because the train is the San Francisco Bay Fill Shoreline Railroad. And San Francisco Bay is the damsel in distress who has been tied to the railroad tracks and is being rescued by the McAteer-Petras Bill, and that's the bill that established the Bay Conservation and Development Commission. But it was only established as a temporary moratorium and a commission to study what needed to be done to the bay. And the bay plan that they produced contained maps of the entire bay after a whole series of public hearings over many years, designating shoreline areas that could be reserved for ports and industry, other areas to be reserved for public recreation, airports, and wildlife refuges. And Save the Bay fought another battle in the legislature in 1961 to make that study commission a permanent agency to regulate the bay. The Bay Conservation and Development Commission, the bill passed by one vote and was signed into law by Ronald Reagan. And that Bay Commission, which still exists today, became the first coastal zone management agency ever in the world, a model copied all over the world and right here in California a few years later with the Coastal Commission to protect our Pacific Ocean shoreline. Since that agency became permanent in 1969, not only has most bay filling been halted, the bay's actually gotten bigger because of diked areas that have been reopened to the tides and where tidal marsh is being reestablished. Save the Bay fought hard over the last three decades to ensure that that turnaround was preserved. And over the decades, we've worked on many issues. Today, as an organization, we're still waging and winning effective advocacy campaigns to protect and restore the Bay. And as we begin our second half century, I wanted to highlight for you some of the things that we're working on, and really three main areas where we've determined that we can have the biggest impact on the health of the Bay, along with tens of thousands of you, over the next several years. We're working to prevent bay fill and inappropriate development on the shoreline where it's still proposed. We're reducing toxic runoff pollution to help protect water quality in the Bay. And we're working to reestablish 100,000 acres of healthy wetlands, which is what scientists recommend for a sustainable bay ecosystem. So let's talk about each of those in turn. You know, despite our early successes, there is still occasionally a proposal to fill in more of the bay. About a decade ago, both San Francisco and Oakland Airport had proposals to fill in more of the bay, and you can see some of the proposals for moving their runways further out into the bay on this diagram. San Francisco Airport's plan would have filled 2 square miles of the bay for a runway reconfiguration project. It would have been the largest bay fill proposal since the Bay Conservation and Development Commission had been created. Now, if you ask the airport director today, John Martin, he'll tell you he is thrilled that we won that battle and stopped those runways from being approved, because it would have been a boondoggle that would have bankrupted the airport. And the airport director feels that so emphatically that he even had his airport commission pass an official policy that they will not fill in more of the bay, and the San Francisco Board of Supervisors did the same. Well, that was a decade ago, but now again, in Redwood City, just down the peninsula, we're facing another big threat, development threat to the bay. You may have heard about this proposal from Cargill Salt and a housing developer called DMB Associates, and it's their proposal to build the equivalent of a new city for up to 30,000 residents on some salt ponds that they still own. These ponds are at sea level, so potentially subject to flooding from rising sea levels. And this proposal would forever destroy one of the last remaining privately owned shoreline open space areas that could also be restored. We believe, and it's been demonstrated very effectively over the last decade, that San Francisco Bay salt ponds can and should be restored to natural wetlands to benefit people and wildlife, and that salt ponds are really an unacceptable place for housing and development. Well, incredibly, this proposal is to build 12,000 homes in this area that has long been a priority for addition to the San Francisco Bay National Wildlife Refuge. And all of the salt ponds around this area have already been dedicated to the National Wildlife Refuge and our federal property in the process of being restored or planned for restoration. So you can see in this photo, on the bottom photo, you can see a satellite view of these salt ponds. They're actually crystallizers. That would be the last stage of salt making. And you can see there the historic tidal channels that are still remnant in the ponds. They haven't been altered that significantly, and that's one of the reasons that they can be restored. And on the top is an overlay of the developer's plan for those homes, reserving a portion of the property potentially for restoration, but a significant portion you can see for housing. In addition to destroying this shoreline restoration opportunity, it's estimated that it would add up to 80,000 daily car trips to Highway 101 because it's not near Caltrain. And it would endanger existing industrial jobs at the port of Redwood City that's right next door, which is one of the last industrial employers in the South Bay. We'll say the Bay's been the leading opponent of this project for the last several years, and we've mobilized thousands of residents in Redwood City and around the Bay Area, more than 150 elected officials from around the Bay Area, and now labor unions and other organizations, all of whom have called on Redwood City to halt consideration of this project, which they have not yet done. This map shows the projected sea level rise over the next 50 years. You can see in the light blue the sort of minimum expected sea level rise in the dark blue areas that would potentially be inundated by moderate or higher level sea level rise. So it's exactly the kind of place that state policy now says should be preserved for wetland restoration. Governor Schwarzenegger adopted this climate adaptation strategy for California, and among other things, it says that low-lying areas that haven't been developed that could be restored to wetlands, that's exactly what you should do there, not put more structures and people at risk of rising sea levels. So we wish we didn't have to still work on preventing fill and inappropriate shoreline development, but occasionally we do. The second priority I want to talk about is preventing pollution. Everything toxic that ends up on our streets and sidewalks runs into storm drains that flow into creeks in the bay when it rains. And with just a few exceptions, and San Francisco is one of them, that stormwater is untreated. It's unfiltered. It goes right into creeks and into the bay. So all the toxic trash, plastic bags, styrofoam, batteries, oil that drips from cars, it all pollutes San Francisco Bay, and that threatens wildlife and public health. This is a photo of Coyote Creek in San Jose, and you can see it looks like you could pretty much walk across it on the trash, and that's not an unusual image from many of the creeks around the bay. So our strategy here at Save the Bay is twofold. First, fight for strong policies to stop this harmful pollution. We've controlled a lot of pollution flowing into the bay and a lot of toxic chemicals. It's shocking that over the last several decades, until 2 years ago, there were no numerical limits on how much trash cities could allow to flow into the bay in this way. So we fought for those limits, and now they're in place. And over the next decade, cities are going to have to reduce the amount of trash they let flow into the bay close to zero. It's supposed to get all the way to zero in the next 10 years. So the second part of our strategy is to then work with cities to help them make it easier for all of us to reduce the amount of trash that gets out into the environment. And that's what our Clean Bay campaign is doing. We're partnering directly with Bay Area cities and helping them to reduce trash at the source. Through best practices, like limiting the distribution of free plastic bags at grocery stores and limiting the distribution of styrofoam takeout food containers when there are really good alternatives that don't affect our land environment or our maritime environment. In San Jose, we fought for and won the toughest plastic bag ban in the state, partnering with key businesses like the Grocers Association. And we just worked with San Mateo County to pass a strong styrofoam takeout food container ban. These are models that we helped create, and we're actually helping replicate them throughout the entire region. The third big area where we're working is to restore tidal marshes. So the bay still supports more than 500 species of wildlife, including 105 threatened and 23 endangered species. In this photo on the left, you can see the California clapper rail, and on the right, the salt marsh harvest mouse. These are two endangered species that only live in San Francisco Bay tidal marsh, and that habitat is quite scarce. The tidal marshes are the main habitat that was eliminated by all that development over the last century. And wetlands are really the lungs of the bay. They're very important for keeping the water clean and giving life to hundreds of fish and wildlife species and billions of small organisms that thrive in the bay mud and are really the base of the food chain upon which all the other species that live in the bay rely. And wetlands provide a lot of other benefits to the community. They help sequester carbon to curb global warming. They protect the shoreline from floods and sea level rise. And, of course, they provide open space in the very densely populated area we live in. And all of that provides economic benefits. It's part of the ecosystem around the Bay Area that makes it a desirable place to live and work. So Save the Bay did a, a, took a close look at what it would take to get the tidal marsh restored that scientists have said we need. There was a 1999 study. Scientists showed that the Bay tidal marsh had been reduced from more than 200,000 acres to about 40,000 acres. And they showed where marshes had been diked but not yet built on, including the salt ponds, and how restoring these areas could get the bay back to 100,000 acres. So we developed a science-based habitat restoration program and policy work to help us get to this goal of 100,000 acres. 8 years ago, we helped convince the state and federal governments to buy more than 16,000 acres of retired salt evaporator ponds in the South Bay and along the Napa River, to buy those and dedicate them to open space and habitat restoration. And then in 2007, we did this study called Greening the Bay, and it showed that the biggest ingredient that was missing to get these areas that were already acquired and reserved for restoration actually restored to tidal marsh was funding. It would cost about $1.4 billion over 50 years, we calculated. And that seems like a really big number until you divide it by 50 years and you realize there are 7 million people living here in the Bay Area. So we did some polling that showed that a large majority of people in the Bay Area would be very willing to help pay for this work, in addition to funds that might come from the federal government and the state, especially because with a very small fee or tax per person, a lot of this work could be accomplished. But guess what? There was no regional agency, even though we have many agencies of government here in the Bay Area, there was no regional agency that actually had that mandate to restore tidal marsh and had the power to propose to voters a fee or tax to pay for it. There was no agency, so we created one. We went to the legislature, sponsored a bill, built support from businesses and local governments, and Governor Schwarzenegger actually signed the bill in 2008, in a year when he vetoed a lot of bills, and created the San Francisco Bay Restoration Authority, which right now is studying where and when an actual Bay Restoration parcel tax might be supported by voters. So you'll probably be hearing more about that in the next few years. Well, meanwhile, on the ground, in addition to this policy work, Say the Bay staff scientists are enlisting 5,000 volunteers annually and training them to restore 7 wetland sites around the San Francisco Bay. And we're really pioneering ways to restore an area called the ecotone. It's the strip of habitat located between the water and the land. And when you restore tidal marsh and let bay waters back into a salt pond or area that had been diked off, most of the vegetation comes back by itself. The seeds of pickleweed and cordgrass come in on the tides and reestablish themselves in the mud. But the areas just above that, the levees that are artificially created, they're all choked with weeds. They don't restore themselves. It takes people to restore them, and that's what we're doing. So you can see an example of that here. Part of the best management practices that Save the Bay has developed with our restoration team are to figure out what kinds of plants are best restored in which of these areas and what kind of techniques work well. And we're not just doing this with adults. We're educating the next generation how to be stewards of San Francisco Bay. In fact, we've provided this kind of experiential education on the Bay shoreline to more than 55,000 students over the last decade, almost half of them from low-income and inner-city areas. And we're using the Bay as a classroom and a laboratory. We offer field trips to middle and high school students, and when they come out, we're teaching them stewardship so they can actually get a sense of how they as individuals can help improve their communities. Well, there are many other challenges facing the Bay besides these three big ones. Global warming, diversion of fresh water from the Delta, oil spills, invasive species, and crumbling sewers. We really have a lot facing us. And that series of challenges is really clear in a new survey of the Bay's health that was published last month. I brought some copies of the San Francisco Estuary Partnership's new scorecard on the Bay's health, and you're welcome to help yourself to those on the back table. It really portrays a challenging picture about what we need to do to make the Bay healthy over the next several years. But what I want to point out is that from Save the Bay's beginnings 50 years ago, organizing the first grassroots movement to save the bay from being paved over, to our work now to reduce pollution and restore wetlands, educate students and adults, there's a common theme. We've been successful by reaching out and engaging a broad and diverse Bay Area community, showing everyone how they can make a difference, and really engaging people. And it's because we all share the Bay. The Bay needs all of us to survive, and it's also because the Bay is never truly saved. Probably the most frequent question I get, sometimes in jest, is, isn't the Bay saved yet? And the answer is no, because there are constant challenges, and the 7 million of us who live here create a big footprint. So we all share the Bay, and the Bay needs all of us to survive. Each generation has to save the Bay again from new threats. So Save the Bay is dedicated to building a larger constituency of engaged Bay residents, enlisting volunteers, reaching people online the way more of us are living our lives these days, and finding ways for people to be engaged in that forum as well. There are so many ways for individuals and Bay Area businesses, adults, and students to get involved and help the Bay and to get out and experience the Bay with us. The Bay is really its best salesman. So a good place to start, as Carrie mentioned, is on our website, savesfbay.org. It's a great place to learn more about the Bay, sign up for updates, learn how to volunteer, and more. When you look at the Bay today, and Carrie said this better than I can, it is hard to believe that 50 years ago the Bay was in danger of becoming a polluted narrow shipping channel. And now a half century later, the Bay is cleaner and healthier. And we're actually about to host the America's Cup. The premier sailing event in the world is going to be here in 2013 with some trial races in 2012. And that's significant. The America's Cup has never been held inside a harbor. It's always been held out in the ocean where you really needed to watch on a helicopter camera on television if you wanted to see it. We have a natural amphitheater right here. But the other thing that it demonstrates, it's really a tribute to the people who worked so hard to save the Bay, because San Francisco Bay would not exist as the beautiful treasure it is today without Save the Bay, and the America's Cup would not be coming to San Francisco Bay if it still was in the condition it was in 1961 and on that trajectory towards failure. So I encourage each and every one of you to get out on the Bay, sign up for a Save the Bay volunteer project, experience the Bay for yourselves. And I'd also like to take this opportunity to personally invite all of you to celebrate 50 years of Save the Bay with us. We're holding a gala celebration here in San Francisco on November 3rd. It's Splash, 50 years of making waves, Thursday, November 3rd. And I promise you it will be an evening of inspiration and fun. And I'd like to point out a member of our board of directors who's helping organize that event is here with us tonight, Maureen Riley. She has invitations to the gala with her, and I encourage you to speak with her about the event. She could tell you all about the fabulous food and live music and exciting auction items we have planned. And it'll be a really inspirational evening to celebrate what all of us have accomplished and what our predecessors have accomplished over the last 50 years. So I want to thank you all again for your interest. I hope to see you out on the Bay, and I look forward to answering your questions. Thank you.
I'd like to remind our listening audience that you're listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. Our speaker has been David Lewis, Executive Director of Save the Bay. And now it's time for audience questions, David. And I'd like to start off with a hard one first. At least I hope it's hard. And that is that, you know, the things that you have, that Save the Bay in its history have prevented, when you look at them in isolation, those are... can be characterized as good things, you know, creating housing, manufacturing. These are the things that we depend on for, you know, for an important part of our lives. So when you take the position of wanting to stop something, what are the criteria? What is the main thing that helps you decide that a particular use, such as you know, something on the old salt ponds or one of those things, is not a good use of that land?
Right. Well, first, if you go back to the point you're making, the whole reason that it became necessary to develop a regional plan and have a regional agency to look at what was good for the bay is because so many cities and counties share the bay. And so before 1965, every city made that same argument. This is our property. We should do with it what's good for us. And it's just a little slice of the bay. But when you add up all those slices and all that challenge to the shoreline and all that destruction, it was killing the bay as a whole. And the bay is an ecosystem, and so what happens in one part of the bay does affect another part. So now, fortunately, we not only have environmental laws that dictate what you can and can't do in the bay, we also have a bay plan from the Bay Conservation and Development Commission, and cities have become enlightened and made plans that take note of the bay as a resource. So, for example, when the cities adopt their general plan and designate areas that should be open space, that's a signal, open space. The bay shoreline, where cities haven't already filled those areas, should be open space. Another good example is that the federal government, the federal the Fish and Wildlife Service at the Department of Interior, has over the years acquired and protected areas in San Francisco Bay that are important for habitat, and they have a plan for where else is not yet protected that should be. So that's in the best interests of fish and wildlife, and then we now have an urban wildlife refuge in the bay that is one of the most visited wildlife refuges in the country. So I think the breakthrough that people in the Bay Area made was twofold. First, realizing we need to plan for the region as a whole, not just individual cities and counties. And secondly, we need to look to the future and preserve what we can for the next generation. I guess the last point I'd make is that all during the 1960s, when these new reforms and restrictions were being proposed, people said, well, you can't stop us from building in the bay. The bay will have no more jobs. There'll be no place for people to live. Our economy will die. You can't stop progress. And what we've learned is that if you have smart rules for where to grow and where to protect, that the economy can thrive. I mean, we're in the midst nationally now of one of the toughest recessions in decades, and the San Francisco Bay Area is doing better than most places in the world. We've found a way to preserve our environment and also grow our economy and give ourselves a great quality of life, and people still flock here for that reason.
I have two questions. First of all, what is it that allows Redwood City to be outside of the regulatory structure that now exists for the Bay? But secondly, a much broader question, are you at all involved in the question of the Lawrence Berkeley Lab moving to the Bayfront? And this is the federal government, in fact, making decisions about our Bay. Basically, tell me the politics of how you get into these things and are successful at them.
Well, first let me answer your question about Redwood City so that it's clear. Redwood City is not outside the regulatory structure. The proposal that I described to you is a proposal for building on land that is protected by Redwood City as open space. Redwood City just updated its general plan. It had an opportunity to say, no, we don't want to preserve the bay and these salt ponds as open space. We want to designate it as an area for development, and they didn't. Instead, they said, we want to continue redeveloping downtown near Caltrain, where people can walk from their homes to transit, walk from transit to work. So it's not outside the city regulatory structure. It's not outside the state regulatory structure. These salt ponds are considered waters of the state, waters of the U.S. government, and that means they have some protections. So there are some very high bars and hurdles for that particular project to ever be approved, and we hope that it won't be, but so far the developers are still proposing it and the city council is still considering it. You asked about another proposal. Lawrence Berkeley Lab wants to expand a campus, and they're looking at several sites that are on the shoreline. And some of those sites are in areas that are not currently designated for the kind of development they are proposing. They haven't selected a preferred site. They're all in the East Bay. Once they do, then it's definitely something that Say the Bay will look at to make sure that they're not proposing something that's inappropriate. Ultimately, as I said at the end of my remarks, there's far more to be done to protect the Bay than we can do. And we're not the only organization. So we try to partner with others. We've tried to pick issues that are where we can make a measurable difference with the resources that we have and the people that we can mobilize. And that means some issues do not go addressed by us, but are addressed by other organizations. And it means some really important problems are not being addressed. That's why we need more people involved.
Could you talk about your work with the Oakland Harbor in particular, and not only just the shipping issue, but also issues that are out above the water, like dealing with diesel trucks and that sort of thing, the need to work with commerce and the health of the bay?
Well, so the Oakland Harbor story is actually a lot like the San Francisco airport story. In the late 80s, most of the Port of Oakland is on filled land. And in the late 80s, they proposed massively expanding their land by filling in more of the bay. And the Bay Conservation and Development Commission and Say the Bay and others prevented them from doing that. They, of course, said at the time, consistent with my previous theme, if you don't let us expand, we're going to die. We won't be able to accommodate the traffic that we need to accommodate with container ships. Well, they were denied expansion of their land facilities, and they found a way to live with the land that they have. They made their operations more efficient. They eliminated some operations that were taking up too much space. And now Port of Oakland is still the third largest port on the West Coast and just a very vibrant operation. They have been forced through citizen action, which Say the Bay deserves no credit for, by the citizens of West Oakland, who are most affected by the air pollution from the trucks and the ships, to start curtailing that air pollution. I think it's another great example of citizens organizing to improve the local environment, and I think it's a great legacy. You do have to notice that many of the most affected communities by pollution in our area generally are filled with underprivileged people and people who are less well off economically. And that's true with the Bay as well. So many of the communities that are right near the shoreline are some of the ones that are the least well off. They're not just affected by pollution, but they're potentially more at risk from sea level rise and flooding. And so these are communities that we need to work with, and we are trying. A lot of these are the areas where we can engage people to help restore the shoreline. Good example is East Palo Alto, one of the lowest income communities in the Bay Area. Right next to Salt Ponds, where Say the Bay is working with hands-on volunteers to restore the salt ponds. And these are communities that had turned their backs on the shoreline or were walled off from the shoreline because there were uses there that were not accessible to the public. So some of these communities, Mountain View, Sunnyvale, Alviso, that didn't even think of themselves as Bay shoreline communities, are rediscovering that they are actually next to the Bay and creating ways for people to connect with the Bay. So in Richmond, too, there's a great reawakening and reconnecting with the Bay that's really inspiring to see. Another question, yeah.
Hi. If the City of Redwood City's general plan has designated the Cargill Salt Ponds as open space, how can it be that the City Council is still for development?
Well, the answer to that question is that any decision of a governmental body can be changed by a subsequent decision of that governmental body. So if the Redwood City Council decides that they want to permit this kind of development, then they would have to also change their general plan and amend their general plan. And that decision could be subject to a referendum by the citizens in that community. In fact, Redwood City has twice overturned development decisions by its own city council on the Bay shoreline. Once in the late 80s at Bear Island, which was proposed for another massive housing and office development. City Council approved it. Local citizens in Redwood City led a referendum that narrowly was successful in stopping that development. The developer became disenchanted with his potential for developing the property and eventually sold it, and now it's part of the wildlife refuge. And in 2004, there was a series of massive office towers proposed right next to there on the shoreline, also approved by the City Council. That one was overturned, not on a close vote, by the Redwood City citizens. So this is history that the City Council has to take into account. We don't know what they'll do, but they have started what looks like it's going to be a very long, slow process of evaluating this project. Instead of just saying, no, this is inconsistent with our general plan, we don't need to consider this.
You showed plans for the expansion of the airports in the Bay. You spoke about San Francisco. What are the proposals by Oakland Airport?
So Oakland, as you know, has one major runway for takeoffs and landings. And all of these runway expansion proposals were motivated by the airports worrying that over time there were going to be more demand for flights landing at these airports than the existing runways would have capacity for. And both these airports are sometimes affected by fog, where there's limitations on how many planes and how close together they can land. So Oakland Airport had a proposal to build a second runway farther out into the bay. It never got as far as San Francisco Airport's proposal, in part because the airport in Oakland is owned by the Port of Oakland, and they decided to put their resources into modernizing the maritime facilities at the port. Interestingly, there's a regional government agency called the Regional Airport Planning Commission. The Association of Bay Area Governments, Metropolitan Transportation Commission, Bay Conservation and Development Commission all do a review of the airport needs of the Bay Area once every 10 years. And in 2000, they did that study, and it said all the airports needed more capacity. Oakland needed more runways. San Francisco needed more runways. Otherwise, there was going to be gridlock. Well, they just did that study again, and in part because of advocacy by Save the Bay, they focused instead on how you could improve the airport's capacity and runway operations without building more runways into the bay. And guess what? They found that a combination of improving technology that allows planes to land more closely in bad weather still safely, more coordination between the airports, using other airports in the region to handle capacity, and, yes, actually putting some limits on how many flights can land at the airport, those all could actually help increase capacity and improve operations at both airports in the next several decades and probably obviate the need to build more runways. And the reason that our airports are on the bay shoreline in the San Francisco Bay Area is because that's the flat place, right? And they were on the shoreline even before there was any fill. But as they became bigger and there was nobody there to stop them, they filled more into the bay. And so, I mean, that's the situation that we found ourselves in, but I think it's a good example of how when people say, no, you can't just fill the bay, that can't be your first choice. You have to look at upland alternatives. You have to look at technology. Well, when people are forced to look at those other alternatives, they find ways of doing things, and often successfully. Other questions?
Yeah. Your 100,000 acres is a nice round figure. You're looking for another 22,000 acres, and I wondered, have you identified these 22,000, and also are there additional acres that might be acquired at some point, and what do you intend to do about those?
So Save the Bay doesn't buy land. But fortunately, there are a lot of great agencies that do acquire land and protect it and restore it. East Bay Regional Park District, one of our partners in the room, have done that, the federal government and the state government. We actually did not identify where these properties were that could get to 100,000 acres. The scientists who did the study in 1999 identified areas. So the areas that could still be acquired that have not yet been are mostly in the North Bay along Highway 37 between Vallejo and Novato. Several large acquisitions have occurred in the last few years, including Skaggs Island and a Dixon Ranch property now called Sears Point, and those are slated for restoration soon. There are still a few other parcels there. And then most of the rest of the 20,000 acres is in the Suisun Marsh, which is the next bay up towards the Delta near Fairfield and Vacaville. And then there's 1,400 prime acres just waiting to be added to that total right in Redwood City. The last privately held area of any great size in the South Bay that's not already protected for that purpose. So we know where those areas are. If they're privately owned, the private owners have the right to hold them or sell them if they want. In most of those areas, they don't have the right to develop on them. They don't have the right to build on them, although they'd like to try to get that. So,
I think we're all looking forward to the America's Cup, which is going to bring a big economic boon projected to San Francisco and the Bay Area. I'm wondering what special concerns the Save the Bay organization has about such an event, which is a lot more complicated than it would appear at first glance.
Well, the America's Cup is really big. It's going to bring a lot of people to the Bay Area for actually a pretty short period of time when races are actually taking place in 2012 and 2013. And so I think we see that mostly as an opportunity. So it's an opportunity for the Bay. The America's Cup team, working with us and other groups, has put together a sustainability plan. And that sustainability plan is, of course, to try to make it a low carbon emitting event and minimize the amount of trash that's created. But the real opportunity with a sustainability plan is to create an event that leaves a legacy after those races are done, a legacy for the Bay, something that helps make the Bay better than it was, healthier, better for fish and wildlife than before the races, better for the San Francisco waterfront. So a plan that helps revitalize crumbling and decrepit and closed-off areas of the waterfront, initially for facilities that will help them run the races, but also providing public access that will be a lasting benefit to the people of San Francisco and help revitalize those areas of the waterfront, and a legacy for the city and the Bay Area of economic activity. So the America's Cup is a complicated event, but I think we have a really high level of confidence that it can be done in a way that actually achieves these goals of sustainability and really makes the Bay better. And the even bigger opportunity that the races provide are to focus people's attention on the Bay. You know, as I said before, people in the Bay Area love the Bay. They care about the Bay. But still, a lot of us take it for granted on a daily basis. And I think the America's Cup has an opportunity to be a great awakening for people here in the Bay Area, another one of those moments, like the negative moments we sometimes have, like the Costco Busan oil spill, where people suddenly realize, hey, I care about this. This is part of my community, and look for something that they can do to help make the Bay better. Well, I think the America's Cup is going to focus the whole world, first of all, on what we've already done to protect this Bay and make it so spectacular and save it from death, and then also what we can do. I think some of the things we've done here in San Francisco Bay can be a model for other parts of the world, a model for how to take care of our oceans and our coastlines. And I think the America's Cup can really focus people in the Bay Area, focus their attention on this amazing jewel that we have in our backyard that, you know, most days we do actually take for granted.
I think you're right about the America's Cup and the potential that it has, particularly for the sustainability, for education, and for leaving the Bay better. But in terms of leaving it better, of course, what they're looking at is leaving it better in some economic terms. Is there the potential that the America's Cup Event Authority would consider leaving the bay better in terms of the ecology and following up in some way on the tidal marsh restoration that you've already identified.
Yes, I think there's a lot they can do. And we're working with them to try to help them understand a couple of really big things that they could do. One is to make engagement and helping out with these agendas for reducing pollution and restoring marshes part of what they are encouraging people to do, right? So they are presenting themselves as the beacon of sustainability and a clarion call for improving the oceans of the world. And they can help people understand the things I've mentioned, the things other groups are doing to help engage people, get people engaged in actually helping with their own hands. But the other thing they can do, frankly, is they're attracting a huge amount of capital and investment. Advertisers, developers, and that's great. It takes a lot of money to run the event. But if you think about it, they're borrowing the bay. They're renting the bay, and we're happy to have them do it. But part of the cost of rental can be establishing some funds that actually do help with these agendas that require resources. And I think it's a fraction of the economic activity that they're going to generate. And it's absolutely fair that some of those resources go back into improving the habitat in the bay, just like they go back into improving the waterfront of San Francisco, which is a public resource. It's held in public trust for all of the people of the state of California by the Port of San Francisco. So I think there are huge opportunities to do that, and I'm very optimistic. I think we have for one more question.
I'd like to remind our listening audience that you're listening to the program The Commonwealth Club. Our speaker is David Lewis. And now we just have time for one last question.
Thank you for taking the time. David, thank you for being here. I should know the answer to this, but I don't. The high-speed rail project, which is going to be coming up the Central Valley and then under the Pacheco Pass, is going to take some acreage out of open space. They're trying to minimize it, but there's going to be significant acreage taken out of open space. They'll have to buy offsets. Can those offsets be applied to acquiring shoreline around the bay?
Well, one of the things I've learned over the years is to say I don't know when I don't know. Probably that is a potential possibility because I think that the tidal marsh restoration that's mostly being done by federal and state government agencies may be a legitimate place for those kinds of offsets and for other kinds of development. So, we'll look forward to learning about whether that can happen and help us close this funding gap.
Thank you very much, David Lewis, for your remarks here this evening. Join me in thanking David Lewis.
Thank you.
And now this program of the Commonwealth Club, observing over a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Thank you. You got me.